I'm going to read bios while our next group comes up here. Who's first?
Josh.
Josh is first, okay. So first up is going to be Josh Shepherd. He's an assistant professor of media studies at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and the National Research Director for the Library of Congress's Radio Preservation Task Force, a digital humanities consortium of 125 academic faculty and 275 state and university archives working to preserve the cultural history of sound in the U.S.
Hello, how you guys all doing? Adjust this here. Okay, so I'm Josh. Today I thought I would begin with a little introduction of the task force and then describe a few of our initiatives. So growing out of the National Recording Preservation Plan of the National Recording Preservation Board, the Radio Preservation Task Force of the Library is the Library of Congress's first national radio history project to focus on non-commercial and local radio history. So the RPTF was mandated by National Recording Preservation Board Chair Sam Berlowski back in early 2014 and is directed by eminent broadcasting historian and NRPB member Chris Sterling, Associate Dean at George Washington University, who is also building the new Corcoran Art School in the old museum that just shut down. Comprised of 125 media history faculty, 275 archives and growing, and the staff at the Library of American Broadcasting at the University of Maryland, Chuck, the Radio Preservation Task Force is currently pursuing a second wave of aggregation of affiliate archives and collections, and we hope to have 500 to 600 or so by the next NRPB meeting in November. So radio shows that aired between 1925 and 1975 locally or over non-commercial media outlets have been preserved in the form of program transcriptions, which will be pretty familiar to most of the audience here. Most often in our case, cassettes, reel-to-reels, and broadcasts pressed to vinyl, 16-inch records usually. Thanks to previous work by the Library of Congress, media libraries, ARSC members, and old-time radio preservationists, the golden age of commercial radio is represented at digital archives fairly well. And the Radio Preservation Task Force continues this work in application to local, regional, non-commercial, and underrepresented movements in broadcasting history. So I was pretty excited about the Pacifica talk just now and some of the findings for that. We also add an additional dimension, though, which is an educational application that covers every graduate program in the United States for film and media studies. That would be our big contribution, we hope, to the general project. So now my role in a project is really to build what we might say as political will for additional stewardship towards radio and sound history preservation within the academic disciplines themselves. So I figure out who's already doing good work in the form of scholarship or digital preservation, how good work overlaps with other good work, and I conceive potential collaborations, goals, and timelines that lead toward a final application of access in classroom learning. So, and it's been fascinating. Sound trails continue where paper trails end, and perspectives and events that have remained unaddressed by primary document records will receive new recognition by focusing preservation on the conversational and community-building character of non-commercial and local radio history. So anecdotally, this point has piqued the interest of many pretty distinguished faculty who have been enthusiastic from the start. While in traditional academic temperament, others have demanded unreasonable titles and money up front with a promise of minimal return if they're in the mood, so they're not in the project. So we're weeding out some of the of those elements right now. But however, thanks to the leadership of the National Recording Preservation Board and Chris Sterling's unusually distinguished reputation within academics, by my current hyperbolic projection, this notion that we might develop new primary source lines for research and for primary secondary school applications has helped us to grow into the largest digital humanities preservation project in the discipline of film and media studies so far. So what do we do with all this free academic labor? So lucky for us, many precedents have been set by previous initiatives, including the American Archives of Public Broadcasting and Pacifica projects, and I've been in touch with Brian DeShazer regarding that. And I'd like to very briefly describe those initiatives as we're moving forward here. So thanks to Sam Berlowski, Steve Leggett, and Carrie Odell at the Packard Center in Culpeper, in February 16, we'll hold a conference at the Madison Building at the Library of Congress for sound archivists and faculty to discuss how we might work together toward the long-term preservation and digital goals that we have set forth in front of us. And the envisioning of it is for a horizontalized project in which they work side by side on this. And over the next 8 to 16 months, the task force will commence multiple projects. Our first mandate is to develop a metadata interface so that educators, radio enthusiasts, and researchers might locate content-specific recordings. So building from these forthcoming analytics, we plan two major initiatives. The first will be to construct a letterhead board of curators, federal and state archives, and media historians to identify and pre-designate archival locations to receive endangered collections before they're discarded or incinerated. Because what we're finding is that through consolidation, a lot of materials are simply being thrown out a year or two before we even know that they could have existed. So one of our goals is to try to save them in advance by when we find out about them having a place to put them. Our second major initiative is to shift from geographic organization, which is the current aggregation of participation, to promote digitization and access through the creation of content-based research caucuses comprised of both archives and research specialists. Our caucuses will work together to identify the most significant newly unearthed recordings chronicled by metadata and apply for preservation and digitization grants through the archives for educational and research applications. Our caucuses will then commence a national educational initiative via multiple digital projects, especially the formidable American Archives of Public Broadcasting project, to provide content analyses, syllabi, and curated exhibits for newly circulating recordings. The American Archives' contribution of newly digitized interviews, music debates, and performance has provided film and media researchers with a new corpus of cultural histories accessible in one place. And this can't really be overstated, especially in terms of its importance to faculty members who want to appropriate this for applications in the classroom and for research and for dissertations and all these kinds of things that could come out of this. So it's exciting work, the American Archives, that it sets a high bar for any similar project that we hope to actually resemble in some ways, in very centered ways, for research-based applications. So looking ahead 24 months and beyond, our large faculty consortium, which we guess will peak out at about 150 faculty members or so, hopes to work with archivists to make selected sound digitizations available for educational fair use by providing examples of what classroom implementation might look like. Okay, thank you very much.
Next up is Karen Cariani, Director of the WGBH Media Library and Archives. Karen has years of experience in project management experience. She has been project director for WGBH's Teachers Domain, digital media resources for K-12 classrooms, WGBH Open Vault, a digital library for WGBH Archives, American Archives Inventory Project, and Boston Local TV News Digital Library Project. She is leading the development and implementation of WGBH DAM system. This is an unfortunate thing that you can say in your work. Right?
That's enough.
She is currently co-chair of Library of Congress's National National Stewardship Digital Alliance for the Infrastructure.
Wow, it's just to stop.
Et cetera.
Let's move on. Okay, the American Archive.
Yeah, and so on.
I'm going to talk to you about the American Archive of Public Broadcasting, which Josh mentioned. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background, and then Casey, the project manager for the project, is going to give you a little bit more detail about where we are. So the American Archive of Public Broadcasting is a collaboration between WGBH and the Library of Congress. This is our website. This is our hashtag Twitter and our Facebook page, so please go visit them. So what is the American Archive? It's an unprecedented historic collection of American public radio and television content. So it's not just television, it's also radio. It dates back through the 1950s when public radio began. And it's the goal is to permanently preserve, as much as we can permanently preserve anything that's digital, collections and materials and content that was created for this network and for this system. And then make as much of it as possible as we can to the public, for scholars, for research, for education, for whatever we can make it accessible for. Who are we? We are the Library of Congress. We're working with the Packard campus of the Library of Congress in Culpeper. And we are WGBH Media Library and Archives. And WGBH is one of the foremost public television and radio stations in the country. We produce about a third of what goes out on PBS. We have four or five radio stations now, I believe. We are an NPR station in Boston, so we create a lot of content. And we have an archive that dates back 60 years. So the American Archive began with an initiative from CPB. CPB is a corporation for public broadcasting. They're the ones that distribute the federal funding to the public media system across the country. And they decided to use monies from the digitization, or from Congress that was originally tagged to move all of the stations into a digital format for broadcasting. They had some leftover money, and they decided to use that money to create this initiative of the American Archive. They started the initiative with a pilot program, which some of the public radio stations here, I think Pacifica participated in the pilot, which was to focus on civil rights movement, to see whatever materials happened to be out there around civil rights and around World War II oral histories. The idea was to inventory it, digitize it, somewhat catalog it, and sort of take some glance look at the rights just to sort of see what was out there and what it would take to do a more massive initiative. The next initiative they funded was a content inventory project, which was this one, which WGBH managed. And the goal there was to really put feelers out there and find out who kept stuff over the last 60 years in your archives, in your tape libraries, in your closets, under your desks. What do you have, and who has it? And the idea was not to catalog, as Jolien and Holly were saying. You'd have to listen to every single piece of item to really catalog it and to really find out what it is. So we didn't want them to do that. That was going to take way too much time. In a lot of cases, that might have been the last time you could play the tape, given the fact that a lot of them are deteriorating. So we told people, just tell us that you've got an item, what format it is, and whatever information you can deem off the box, and send that to us in an inventory. CPB funded about 120 stations to do these inventories. Unfortunately, Pacifica Radio wasn't one of them, but we tried to get their records anyway, across the country. And from that inventory, we have 2.5 million records. So we know there's at least 2.5 million items out there that people kept that they thought were valuable. Then CPB funded the next wave, which was to take the stations that were involved in the inventory, have them make a selection of materials from that inventory and digitize it. And they funded a huge digitization project where they digitized 40,000 hours of this material that came from about 100 stations. So a few stations that were involved in the inventory dropped out of the digitization project, but we still had 100 stations involved. So from the 2.5 million inventory records, 40,000 hours ended up being about 68,000 to 70,000 items, roughly speaking. And that digitization project has been completed. The next phase was to find a home. Oh, I'm going to back up. So the next phase was to find a home for the American Archive in this initial collection of materials, and WGBH and the Library of Congress were chosen as the future stewards for this collection. So just so you know, of that collection, almost half of them were radio stations that participated. And if you can see here the number of items that were digitized, there was a huge number of quarter-inch audio that was digitized. So the collection is not just television, it is radio, and it's everything from talk shows to music shows to symphony orchestras to anything. It's all there, and it's all fabulous content. Our current status is that we are working with the Library of Congress to ingest the 40,000 hours of digital files into their systems. They will be responsible for the long-term preservation of the digital files. WGBH is responsible for access and interaction with the public media system and community and trying to engage them with this material and engage them to continue to archive their materials and grow the collection. We launched the website for public access just recently. The 2.5 million records from the inventory project is now available to the public to search and look for it. We're hoping in October, Casey can tell you a little bit more about that, to be able to stream some of the content that has been digitized. Public access to all 40,000 hours of the proxy files, though, is available on location at WGBH or the Library of Congress. You just have to call us and make an appointment. So next steps are to allow as much online access as we possibly can, rights permitting, to the proxy files. We're working really hard on that. Casey will tell you more. We're going to launch the NET inventory project. We have some funding from CLEAR to try to build an inventory of early national educational television titles that was pre-PBS that exist across the country. Those were the tapes that were bicycled around, so there are tapes everywhere throughout the country, and we're trying to get a handle on what those titles are and where that material might be. We're also going to launch an NDSR fellowship program as a model from the fellowship program that was happening in Washington, New York, and Boston, where we'll be placing recent graduate students at public media stations across the country. We have funding to give stipends to eight fellows for 10 months to work actually at a public media institution, not necessarily just a station, to help them with their digital archiving. We're working to develop a sustainability plan. That's a real tough one. If anybody has any suggestions, please let us know. And we're going to continue to enhance the website. So our long-term goals are to grow the collection by adding new inventory records and digitized materials. If anybody out there has any public media material, content that either went out on a public broadcasting station, TV or radio, or by an independent producer who was producing for public media, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you and add your records to our inventory. We'd like to help public media organizations with archiving, digitizing, and access to their collections overall. And we'd really like to build a consortium for preservation and access of this content, because we think it's really important content to our cultural heritage. We're also continuing the development of PBCORE. PBCORE was a metadata standard that was developed out of the public broadcasting community. That development is continuing. We're re-engaging that community and trying to get them excited again about moving to the next phases of PBCORE and filling out the gaps of what it didn't quite do for everybody. We're reaching out to new adopters, and we're collaborating with EBU CORE, the European Broadcasting Union, to try to develop an RDF ontology for PBCORE, possibly merging the two standards since they are so very similar. It seems silly to have two standards doing the same thing. We might as well join forces there. I'll pass it over to Casey.
Casey Davis is the project manager for the American Archive of Public Broadcasting at WGBH. Her professional interests include access and use of audiovisual archival materials, navigating copyright and fair use to expand access, and the importance of increasing training and education among LIS graduates in the area of audiovisual digital preservation and access. She chairs the PBCORE Advisory Subcommittee for the Association of Moving Image Archivists and is co-chair of the New England Archivists Membership Committee and Roundtable for Early Professionals and Students. And this goes on and on and on. When do you sleep?
The last thing I wanted to say is that I collect embroidered patches. And if you see any at any historic sites or museums around here, I'm looking for one. I don't have a Pittsburgh patch yet, so. Fort Pitt? Okay. So I wanted to go into a little bit more detail about our processes making our content more discoverable and accessible. I'm not going to really talk about preservation because as the project manager at WGBH, my focus is access and outreach to the participating organizations. So first off, I wanted to talk a little bit about discoverability and metadata. So as Karen said, we've got 2.5 million records for assets that exist at more than 120 public media organizations across the country. And of those 2.5 million assets, we just digitized 68,000 of them. So there's a lot of content now that we have now accessible in a digital file and can make more discoverable for researchers. So we're using the PBCORE, as Karen said, the Public Broadcasting Metadata Dictionary Project. We're using it for descriptive metadata, for administrative or rights metadata, and technical metadata for the content that we've digitized, and we're using extensions in PBCORE for our premise metadata, which is the preservation metadata for the content that we've digitized. So to fully catalog our collection, it would take one person working 32 years full-time, no sick time, no vacation, that doesn't include weekends, so they would get their weekends off. So what we're doing is a four-phase approach to cataloging. We have completed the inventory, so we've got 2.5 million records, and now we're concurrently working on normalization and minimum viable cataloging, and then eventually, maybe, a long time from now, we may be able to fully catalog and, you know, provide wonderful Library of Congress subject headings to our records. But what we're doing right now is normalizing the 2.5 million records on a very high level, series level basis, not series as in archival description, but series as in series of programs, by splitting out titles and normalizing dates, because we have our records came from 120 sources. A lot of them were, you know, the people who write the grants for the public media station, or the tech, or the engineer, or an intern. So it's all over the place. So we're doing normalization, and we have a lot of interns from Simmons College that are coming and doing minimum viable cataloging. That is watching the credits, looking for contributors, creators, dates, adding rights information when it exists in the credits, writing short descriptions, and applying genres. And I'll talk a little bit more about genres in a minute. For our management system, we're using the AMS, which was developed with CPB funding. It was developed by Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, and the AMS provides WGBH and the library with an interface for cataloging the collection and for creating new metadata records. It also allows the public media organizations that are participating in the project to view their proxy files, to edit their own metadata. And it also provides the digitization vendor with an interface for creating and submitting technical metadata that's compliant with PBCorp, and also submitting premise metadata, which can then all be exported from this system in a nice little directory. Also, as I said, it provides the opportunity for us to watch the proxy files and catalog. And the AMS is open source, and it's available on GitHub. I should have added the link, but it's github.com/avpreserve/AMS. But we also, we have a separate application for our public-facing website. We didn't want users to go to the AMS to find stuff in our collection. We wanted to have a nice, pretty website for researchers and educators and students to come and look for material. We just soft launched the website, and it's a blacklight application that uses solar, a solar index. From the AMS, there's a PBCorp API, so we're getting that metadata from the AMS, and then we ingest it into the Solar Index. Technical information aside, it's really providing users with a way to search and discover the 2.5 million records. We also have a very active blog. We're trying to feature content. Well, right now we're not really featuring anything except for records, but in October we will be featuring content. And we're also providing information for our participating organizations, like resources and information about how to get their metadata, submit new metadata, submit their collections. If you go to our website and you click on About, we have a really great history of the project. So Karen was only able to start with the pilot project, but the AAPB really dates back to 1967 with the Public Broadcasting Act, and I recommend you reading it. It's really good reading material that our project director at the Library of Congress wrote, so we have a nice history on the website as well, which I love. Here's just a screenshot of so when one searches the website. We have a grid view and a list view of retrieved items. Right now we're working on making the website more user-friendly. I've gotten a lot of emails from people saying, how do I find stuff that's digitized? So we need to think about the usability of the website and make sure that people know when they're coming to the website what's available and how to find what they're looking for. Here's just an example of a record page. We decided not to pull all of the metadata from the AMS into the public-facing website because most of our users are not going to want to know the bit rate of the preservation file. So we pulled most of the descriptive metadata and just metadata that we knew that researchers were going to actually use or care about. So as I said, we're continuing the website development through October 2015, and we're also addressing the usability issues. So if you do go to the website, we really appreciate your feedback on how it can be improved and what you thought you would find but didn't find, and what you found but you didn't want to find, or anything like that. Also, in October, we're launching our online reading room, which will provide online access to as much content that we are able to clear rights for by that time, and I'll talk to you a little bit more about our rights strategy. And by October, we are developing some curated exhibitions. We're thinking of doing one on urbanism, one on climate change, and a few more curated exhibitions, which will be the first pilot exhibitions featuring content of topical historical significance. But eventually, once we launch these three or four curated exhibitions in October, we will be working with the Radio Preservation Task Force to continue development of additional curated exhibitions of content in the collection. So I talked a little bit about how we can make the content discoverable, but can we make it accessible? So I'll talk a little bit about our rights strategy. We've been working since last October with the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School to figure out how we can make as much of this content as accessible as possible, given the very extensive rights issues that abound in the collection. We've got content from 100 different stations. They've been storing these tapes in their closets for 60 years, and there's not many contracts. There's not a lot of documentation about what rights the stations actually have. So we have a few different layers of right now we will be providing two layers of access in October. First off is on-location access to the entire collection at GBH in the Library of Congress. But this is a national collection. We need to make it more more accessible and beyond those two Eastern Seaboard access locations. So in October, we're going to launch the online reading room. It's going to provide online viewing and listening access for research, educational, and informational purposes. And we're also exploring the possibility of setting up additional hotspots where people can go to another library and look at the entire collection. Right now, as I said, it's just GBH and the Library of Congress, but wouldn't it be nice if eventually someone could just go to their local public library and view the entire collection? So that's one of the research topics that we're looking at with the Berkman Center. Another thing that we're looking at providing is password-protected, time-restricted access to digital files that we determine can't go in the online reading room because there are too many rights issues or it's just too big of a risk to make it available online. So a little bit more about the online reading room. The steps that we're doing to make the content accessible, first we're obtaining a quit claim from the contributing station to the extent that they own the rights. So as you know, most of the material that we've digitized is local, but a lot of times there are going to be third-party rights issues or other legal issues. But if we once we obtain the quit claim to the right that the station has the rights, we're doing a high-level review of the metadata for each station, and we're assigning different genres or categories at the series level. And then based on the genre or category, we're determining whether or not it can go on the online reading room or if it needs to stay on location. We have come up with a very extensive list of categories. We have some greenlit categories that we know will go on the online reading room in October. And these are all of our greenlit categories. As you see, you don't see music here. You don't see public performances of music. You don't see instructional programming. But these are all of the categories that we've determined are transformative use when we're making them available online. But in total, we hope to be able to make between 3,000 and 14,000 of the 68,000 items available online by October. And that may not seem like a lot, but it is a lot for this content that would have never been available otherwise and is now going to be accessible for researchers now and in the future, and hopefully we'll be able to continue researching these other potential opportunities for providing access in other ways. And then continued efforts, as Karen said, we're doing the National Educational Television Collection Catalog Project, the AAPB National Digital Stewardship Residency Project. We're kicking both of those projects off next week. So in early spring of next year, we'll be doing a call for applications from stations and then a call for applications from potential residents. And the residencies would happen from October 2016 to July 2017. And then we're working on collection development and growth beyond the 40,000 hours. We have a few irons in the fire right now. I won't say them because I don't want to jinx us, but hopefully we will be growing the collection really soon with some really wonderful National Historic content. We have an advisory council. Oh, you still can't see the names, but we have an advisory council. Norman Lear, Newt Minow, Cokie Roberts, Gwen Ifill, Bruce Raymer, John Patak, Deanna Markham, Senator Ed Markey, Henry Becton, and Beth Courtney. So they will be guiding us with our strategic direction and helping us promote the project and helping us with funding and sustainability issues. I have a quote. It's, "The service that the AAPB has to offer is opening a new world for people like me who spend our time studying the public airwaves of the past." And that was a quote from Jessica Brandt, who's a PhD candidate at Drew University, who recently came to visit GBH and used the AAPB collection for her research into how public media handled the Cold War and how it reported on the Cold War. We've had several PhD researchers come and use the collection since we've been able to make it available on location. So hopefully that number will just grow as we are able to put stuff online. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Batting cleanup is Chuck Howell. He has, since 2012, has served as the collections leader for special collections in mass media and culture at the University of Maryland in College Park. And I'm going to, you want to test the sound?
Hello.
The playback.
Testing. I'm here.
I'm going to leave the time for reading the bio to Chuck to be able to present, because we're running late.
Okay. My friends, I come today to preach the gospel of saving the cool stuff. I come to preach partnership. It really is a gospel to this audience, the work we do, and me. And so I'm in a unique position because I stand sort of in the overlap. If I had a Venn diagram to display, I'm sort of like right dead center as a curator and as an archivist between the American Archive Project and the Radio Preservation Task Force, because the two main collections that I'm responsible for in mass media and culture are the Library of American Broadcasting, which covers the waterfront in terms of commercial radio and television, and the National Public Broadcasting Archives, which, among other things, contains the archives of the National Public Radio, Maryland Public Television, WAMU, and WETA, radio in Washington, D.C., the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, Corporation for Public Broadcasting Materials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm here to talk about what it's like sort of in the trenches and the kind of material that I see these two projects working to save with a collection like my own. And there is an overlap between these two projects, and I think that overlap will hopefully allow for a concentration of effort in the area of overlap, and hopefully a chance to reduce duplication of effort. Let me just play one brief bit of this clip. This is a clip from the National Association of Educational Broadcasters collection, and it was one of the items of the over 7,000 items that we were able to get preserved as part of the American Archive of Public Broadcasting. But by the definitions of the Radio Preservation Task Force's work, it would also fall under the auspices of that project as well. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Close iTunes. Where is it?
Sorry. Oops.
The National Association of Educational Broadcasters welcomes you to a special interview with Earl Williamson, one of the 41 Americans who toured Communist China after attending the Moscow Youth Festival. Although some of Mr. Williamson's remarks may be construed as being sympathetic toward Communist China, this program is being broadcast in order to demonstrate the impressions which could be gained by Americans traveling in China today. Here to question Mr. Williamson is Colin D. Edwards.
Well, Mr. Williamson, would you like to tell us first something about the trip to Peking from Moscow? You came by the Trans-Siberian Railroad, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, we took the sleeping cars from Moscow, and it was a very long trip. We lost an hour a day and by time zones. It was very pleasant, very comfortable.
Well, it's an amazing clip. It's basically goes on for about half an hour, the interview with this young man who had the opportunity to go to China as part of a youth conference at the height of the Cold War. I just don't know how to work this thing. So how do I get out of this screen? Okay. So the overlap between the two collections, or the two projects, excuse me, occurs only on the radio side, as the Radio Preservation Task Force obviously has nothing to do with television at this point, but there is a considerable overlap between the two, including networks like the National Association of Educational Broadcasters and another large collection of material we have from the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which came into being shortly before the cutoff point of the Radio Preservation Task Force work. So if there's a way to identify the material that would fall within the auspices of both projects and concentrate resources in that area through a partnership, then that would obviously free up other funds and resources for the parts of the projects that don't overlap, which on the Radio Preservation Task Force side would include commercial radio of every description, non-network, and on the AAPB side, it would be all of public broadcasting television production. So there's more than enough work to go around, but I think that we can definitely concentrate our efforts and save a little money in that regard by working more closely together. There are also things that each collection project can learn from each other, I think, in the approaches they've taken. The American Archive of Public Broadcasting did an amazing job in the early days of the project with their SWAT teams identifying materials all around the country, going into stations, into smaller underfunded archives, cataloging this material, creating this gigantic database that my colleague spoke about. Millions of items have been identified. And I think something of a similar nature, if the money can be found, would be a terrific boon to the Radio Preservation Task Force, because there's a large amount of material certainly that has been identified that exists in archives, but there's also a tremendous amount of material squirreled away in radio stations and closets and engineers' basements all around the country that is in desperate need of preservation. I'm afraid that I'm running out of time, and I don't want to stint Uncle Dave, but I just want to read one letter from our next presenter that sort of sums up part of the reason why I got into this line of work. It was written to my colleague, Laura Schnitker, at the University of Maryland. Dear Laura, whoa. Downloaded the files you sent yesterday, and I just want to share that when I listened to the first Boone County Jamboree you sent, tears came to my eyes. I was despairing a little bit, as some of the material I was turning up for the talk wasn't that inspiring. And I was wondering if the thrust of my talk, that we need to pay attention to Midwestern rural radio because there doesn't seem to be a lot of it around and it may be getting away, might not be supported by quality samples to share. However, I was pleased to trade those beads of sweat gathering at my brow for those tears of joy. So just kind of editing on the fly here, but I mean, this is really the kind of feedback that when you get that as an audiovisual archivist, when you found that rare bit of material that a dedicated researcher and historian has been looking for, and you realize that, wow, you know, this may be the only example of this in the country at this moment remaining, and we found it for this person, and we've preserved it. And that's just one tiny example of the kind of work that both of these projects are doing that is so important and makes me so proud to be affiliated with each of them. And I had other audio to play, but I think we're going to hear some very good audio from Uncle Dave here in just a couple moments. So I'll let it go at that. Thank you.